It's time to travel to the next room with Jane Asher, an exploration of the bigger picture surrounding life on Earth and what follows. Now, here's your host, Jane Asher, on Empower Radio.
Welcome to the next room. And this is super exciting because normally I'm in this little studio, which you can kind of see my little area. I don't know how big the studio is, but I normally just do it on the radio and I broadcast on Empower Radio. But this weekend, I have the distinct pleasure of broadcasting from the beautiful Dying Expo. So all weekend long, you know, if you're in your booth or in my booth right now, you'll see all kinds of different videos. I interviewed Sarah Seidelman, Brett Johnson, Jesse Brezendine. Who else did I have on? Oh, Vicky Roncero, who also has a booth here at the beautiful Dying Expo. So please go explore this expo. If you're grieving, you can go into, there's a beautiful room that you can go into and just get some support and some love and, you know, connect with people. You can, you know, collect those little digital business cards and go hear our keynote speakers. And it's really here for you all weekend long. It's free, which is fabulous. And you can just use your little digital fingers and go around and go visit all my friends in their booths and support all of these wonderful people in the death and dying community. Okay, this beautiful lady right here she's on my left right now. I don't know if you're watching it, what side she's on, but Barbara Bartolome. And Barbara and I became very good friends very quickly when I was introduced from my other fabulous Barbara in Santa Barbara. Barbara said, oh, you have to meet my friend Barbara. She had a near-death experience, and it's pretty darn miraculous, her story. So I first invited her to come on the next room, and we talked, I think, a couple months ago. And then when this beautiful Dying Expo came up, I'm like, oh, good. I know who I want to have on. I want the amazing story of what you went through. And I love that we're on video here today so we can like literally see you as you're telling your story. Barbara's now the founder of IN Santa Barbara, the chapter in Santa Barbara. It never existed until she decided that it needed to happen. And you'll find out why when she tells you her amazing story. So Barbara, I know, but for the people that are just tuning in, what the heck happened to you? You literally died. So I want you to tell us the story of what happened and why you became such an advocate for the near-death community.
Well, it was way back in 1987, and I was here in Santa Barbara, and I was not happily married to a very abusive person. And I had a son from my previous marriage. He had a daughter from his. The daughter didn't live with us, but my son did. And I was just facing a lot of anger from him. He was an engineer here in Santa Barbara, and he had a lot of pressure on his job. And it would just blow all the time. And then he would apologize, and we would go back to normal again, and it would blow again. And I could never tell when anything was going to happen. And he was physically abusive as well as emotionally and verbally abusive. So I was struggling. I wasn't telling anyone about the situation. And I had left him for a year, and he had begged me to move back, saying that he'd had counseling and that he was over it and that he was fine. I moved back in, trusting him, and found that he wasn't fine, and unfortunately became pregnant. And I was going through my pregnancy, and my baby was delivered in July of 1987, little beautiful little redheaded girl. And in August of 1987, he called me out to the backyard and wanted me to lift something that was way too heavy. I'd had a problem pregnancy. And he ended up forcing me to do the lifting, and it caused a rupture in my disc in my spine. And I blew out my disc between my L5 vertebrae and my S1. So after the first doctor initially told me that I would never walk again, the people that were surrounding me that were friends of mine said, you have to check with someone else and you need to go get another opinion. So I went to a neurosurgeon and he said, he was kind of cocky and he said, yes, I can fix this. And so I was really hoping that that would be the case, not wanting to not walk again at age 31, having, you know, a newborn baby and an 8-year-old son. And so we scheduled the surgery for December of 1987. It was actually going to be on the 8th of December. But on the 7th of December, they wanted me to go into the hospital to do one last test to check to see if when the disc blew, if the spinal cord had been damaged by the disc fragments and if I was losing spinal fluid. So it's called a myelogram. And they had me prepped on the table and they told me the people that were in the room, x-ray techs, a nurse, and both the doctors told me that if I moved at all during the test that I could have headaches for months afterwards. I was to hold completely still. They were going to inject iodine to the spinal cord and then tip the table. And they were going to raise my head, lower my feet, and have the dye run down my spine with gravity. And they were going to be able to x-ray my spine to see if there were any, you know, damages to it. So they started the procedure and I was laying face up on the x-ray table and they started moving the machine, started moving the table, and I immediately began feeling very weird and I thought, you know, is this supposed to be like this? I'm feeling kind of funny. And I didn't want to interrupt anybody because the two x-ray techs were talking to each other and the two doctors were kind of behind the x-ray tech that was next to the bed area. And
You're conscious though when this is happening.
Yes, I was completely conscious. They did not give me any anesthesia or anything else. I was completely other than a numbing area in my upper back area where they injected the dye into, they didn't do anything else other than that.
So something was not right.
Yeah, it felt very not right. And I didn't want to interrupt people. So I was laying there thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe this is just a pass. And it just got worse. And by the time that I realized, okay, look, I need to say something. This is really bad. I'm feeling very horrible. And I felt like I was going to faint. And by the time I realized that, literally the dye had gone into my brain because they were tipping the table the wrong way. They were not watching. No one noticed, but the guy had his finger on the wrong button and he was lowering the head and raising the feet. So the dye they just injected into the upper part of my back, lower part of my neck, was going flowing into my brain.
Oh my goodness. Yeah,
it was really bizarre. And I, by the time I realized I needed to say something, I couldn't open my mouth and speak. I couldn't coordinate speaking. And I also couldn't lift my arm and make my arm move to touch them. So I was feeling trapped in my body. I knew that I was going to faint. I did not know I was going to die. I would have been way more panicked at that point. And I just had to lay there until something happened. So what happened was that I started hyperventilating. My brain couldn't control my bodily functions any longer.
Sure.
And because of the dye that was invading it. And so another neurosurgeon told me this is what had happened. And so I started hyperventilating and the two x-ray techs noticed that. And the x-ray tech with his finger on the button leaned over the table and looked into my face, and my eyes, I remember, were rolling backward, and I was trying really hard to make them stay present and forward and, you know, be okay, and I was fighting it. And he then leaned back to see where he had his thumb on the x-ray table, and then he made this face like,
oopsie daisy,
like, oh my God. And so that was the last thing that I saw, him making that face of, oh my God, and then my eyes shut. Simply shut on the x-ray table. And in the next second, I opened my eyes and I was above the x-ray table, feeling as though the ceiling was touching the back of my head, like I had, you know, met the barrier. I was against the ceiling. And
up, like you were up
right above my body. Yep. Yep. And looking straight down.
And see, but seeing your, could you see your body laying there on the
everything table? In the x-ray room, all the people, my body. And it was interesting that my body, once I was out of my body, looking down at my body, I didn't really feel a connection to it. It was really, to me, nothing more than a wetsuit that I had been occupying. Everything that I was, who I was in my consciousness, was up on the ceiling. And I was very calm up there. I had been panicking just a moment before. And the second that I was up on the ceiling, it was very calm. I looked down at the people's heads and my body on the x-ray table. And I said, huh, if I'm up here and my body is down there and that man is calling code blue, I think I just died. So it was very calm and it wasn't alarming. And the next second, after I said that, I realized that someone, a presence, was there with me on the ceiling. And people have, you know, asked me and actually, you know, had problems with me saying it was a presence. But for me, it felt like it was what I would explain God to be. It felt immense, immensely loving. I felt like I was just wrapped in the warmest, sweetest blanket, and I felt so connected to that being. And so I don't like to say, you know, in case anyone doesn't believe in God, I just the presence was so beautiful. And I believe, honestly, that that presence shows up for every single person, no matter what religion, color, age, shape, anything. I believe that presence is there for everyone. And I began to talk to the presence in,
I just want to ask. All right. So you're up on the ceiling. You're looking down at this wetsuit of a body, totally at peace. And you have this presence. Could you physically see the presence, or it was just a feeling?
It was a huge feeling. And I felt that I knew the presence so well that I didn't feel like I needed to even look over to see what the shape or if there was a physical presence. I knew that presence so well that I just continued to watch, because everything down below was actively crazy going with resuscitation efforts. Right. So there was this whole big mess going on down below.
People watching them.
And I'm watching everything come up above.
Right, back to life. All right.
Yes, but I'm talking to him in this calm, you know, mind-to-mind matter, and saying I really needed to go back into my life because I wanted to be able to continue supporting my children, especially since we were facing this trauma with my, you know, current husband, his abuse, and I didn't want them to be alone. So I was saying that to the beings, I needed to go back to be with them, to support them through it. And it took about 8 to 10 minutes for them to resuscitate me. They brought in an oxygen cart. I watched the woman connect that up to my face. Initially, they were doing CPR, both the chest compressions and the blowing in my mouth. But once the oxygen cart came in, they just put that on my mouth, and they did continue to do the chest compressions. And they were calling for a defib unit. And the lady at the desk that was the nurse kept saying, stat, stat, which means immediately. And so it never came in. And so this man did come in, and I was watching as he put this box on the shelf next to the x-ray table. It was kind of a shelf along the wall, and he stood between the shelf and the x-ray table, and he was putting these little white round things on my chest, peeling the backs off them and sticking them on my chest. You know, I'm not a TV watcher, and I didn't know what that was. So I asked the being, as I was talking to him, telling him I wanted to go back, I said, what is that he's doing? I understand everybody else, but what's that? What's he doing? And I was immediately moved down in front of the box so that my consciousness was right in front of this box that he had. It wasn't turned on yet. He finished putting the white things on, and then he leaned over, and I watched his hand go across my face, part of my vision, and he flicked a toggle switch on the side of the box, and a little green light lit up in the front of the box in this, you know, rectangular area that was green, and it started going straight across in a straight line, and the box was making this monotone sound. Well, I hadn't seen a heart monitor. I was 31 years old. I wasn't into medicine and I didn't watch TV. I didn't know what it was. And I watched it go across and I watched it the second time cross the screen. And the third time it went across about a third of the way over, I went,
"Holy crap, oh, that's my heart.
That's my heart. It's not beating. Oh." So a minute I recognized what it was funny that I was moved back up on the ceiling again, looking straight down at my body and everyone's heads and everything that was going on up by where I felt the being was. So it was pretty awesome. It lasted quite a while. They were doing all sorts of trying to get me restarted. And finally, the neurosurgeon spoke to the orthopedic surgeon. They'd kind of been standing back giving orders and everybody else had been working. And he said, "Too much time has passed. She's going to be brain dead. We need to do something."
Oh my.
And the orthopedic
surgeon heard this. So you're
full. Oh yeah. I watched and heard everything that was going on in the room.
As you're hearing this, that you potentially could be brain dead, did it bother you?
No.
You're like,
it didn't at all. Yeah, up there was no fear, no upset, no. I was completely calm and was just watching everything. And, you know, I guess if I'd had to stay up there, it would have been fine. I'm not sure what would have happened with my children. But, you know, everyone always talks about how, you know, calm and wonderful it is on the other side. So I guess I was just, you know, not worried about having to stay, but wanting to go back. Mm-hmm. And so the orthopedic surgeon stepped a couple steps forward. He first said, "Stand clear." And so the people that were around the head and the chest area of the table, you know, my head and chest area, they stepped backwards and he stepped two steps forward, took his fist from behind his back and arced it over his head and came down and pounded my chest. And I didn't feel it. I was up on the ceiling. I watched him do it. And right as he did that, right as he struck my chest, finally the being that I had been talking to spoke to me. And it was just this super calm, beautifully deep, resonant voice that said, "But if you go back, you'll still be in your marriage. Mm-hmm. What will you do?" Mm. And that was incredible. Then I was shown all these little film clips that just click, 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 of all these times that I had been hit, shoved, kicked, degraded, demoralized. Everything that had happened with the behaviors of my husband were shown to me in these little clips to remind me of what I'd been living through. Mm-hmm. And then I was given all the time, I guess, that I needed to evaluate what I wanted to do. So I, up on the ceiling, thought about the steps that I had taken through the marriage to try to get changes out of my husband. And everything from, you know, crying to begging to writing, you know, a letter to, you know, taking him to marriage family counselor to taking him to a pastor of the church. Everything that I could have done, I had done. And it had all not worked. It had not worked. And so I came to the realization after I thought of all those things that I'd done that I needed to leave him. So I said to the being, "If you let me go back, I promise you I will get strong enough to leave him." The second I said "him," then the doctor did the second precardial thump, is what that's called. It's a last-ditch effort when they can't get the defib unit in there and it's a shock to the heart and hopefully it'll start beating again. It's very rarely used. It's very rarely a positive situation. It usually doesn't work. But that second blow did restart my heart. I don't think I was in charge of the whole situation, and neither were the doctors. And I closed my eyes from up on the ceiling, and I opened my eyes, and the doctor's fist was right there on my chest. He was just lifting it, and his face was just arm's length away. And I looked at him, and I said, "What just happened?"
Wow.
And the nurse leaned over me and said, "Stop, don't talk, we need to stabilize you." So for 20 minutes, they did whatever their stabilization, and then they took the oxygen mask off. And I said, what just happened? I was up on the ceiling and I could see and hear everything that was going on. What happened? And the doctor was like, the neurosurgeon guy had stepped forward as next to the orthopedic surgeon, and he goes, "Oh, brother." And that just caused me to completely continue to talk. And so I said, no, I was sitting here. I was able to see everything. I was up on the ceiling. I saw my body. I saw him do this, that, do that. She said that. You said that. You did this. You did this. I completely recovered everything that was, you know, said and done. And that made the neurosurgeon freak out.
Sure.
He just stormed out of the room. He said, "I'm not going to stand here and listen to this." Yeah.
Yeah, you tripped him out.
Oh, well, definitely.
I'm sure they're probably thinking, oh boy, here we go with a lawsuit, you know?
Exactly. And I think that's why for the next 4 days, they didn't want to, no one would talk to me about it.
Of course not.
No one told me it was called a near-death
experience. He's the crazy woman who died, who was up on the ceiling alone.
Exactly.
To go by her room, just like shove the juice under the door. Oh, I can imagine. You were probably
exactly.
Like,
and when I would ask,
exercised.
Yeah. I'd ask the nurses when they'd come in to bring the juice, you know, "Can you tell me what happened during the myelogram?" And they'd look at the chart and they'd say, "I don't see anything on here. I don't know what you're talking about." And I was like, when they did the surgery the next day, they came into the, recovery area, and the two doctors were coming towards my bed. And I said, what was it that happened last?" And the doctor, the neurosurgeon, like held out his hand. "Do not talk about that. I'm not here to discuss that. I'm here to discuss your surgery." And so they closed me down completely. And I, when I talked with my husband at the time, I told him after I got out of recovery, I told him what had happened. And he said, "That's not possible. You probably hallucinated it." I've had a secret.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, I have the complete cleanest record of anyone. I have a Department of Defense secret clearance that I qualified for when I worked for an aircraft company here in Santa Barbara. I never smoked. I never drank. I didn't do drugs. It's like, oh my gosh, hallucinating? Why would that be happening?
And you're not a woman that's like seeking some kind of attention. I mean.
Yeah, it was bizarre. So I stopped talking about it.
Okay, yeah. So that shut you down. You're like, okay, whatever. I know I was dead. I saw the whole thing, but obviously nobody's embracing this or
right.
Wanting to speak my truth.
Yep.
So how do you go from that to becoming the founder of IAN Santa Barbara?
About 12 or 13 years later, my little baby had grown up and she was in gymnastics class at the university that I worked at here in Santa Barbara. And we were at a practice and another mom was sitting next to me. She happened to be a nurse at the hospital here. And she was telling me how her mom was impendingly going to die that week, that she was on her last leg. And so I felt in my heart that telling her about my near-death experience might help her with coping with her mom's impending death. So I told her what had happened, and she was completely calm with me. Of course, 13 years had passed, sure. And the internet had come up, and she said, "Barbara, that's called a near-death experience, and there are a lot of people online that have had them, and a lot of nurses, experience this with patients right in front of them, and the patients will talk to us about what happened, but they'll never talk to the doctors." Mm-hmm. And so it was really amazing. I went online and I started researching, and I found two organizations, both NDERF, which is Near Death Experience Research Foundation, mm-hmm. and IANS, which is International Association for Near-Death Studies. And both of them support experiencers and give our stories out to the world so that other experiencers can see that they're not alone.
Right. And not to fear it and not to, I can't imagine what that did to you for the 12 or 13 years that you weren't able to speak about it. I mean,
I put it in the box and I just shut the door on it. And
yeah.
It was funny that when I would think about it, though, I could actually like almost put myself back up on the ceiling again and look and see where each one of the individuals, I can still do it now when I talk about it, each one of the individuals were standing. And like, it's a real visual inside my head
right.
To be up on that ceiling. And so it's more visual than memories of my wedding, you know, or memories of childbirth. It's real and it's so awesome. So
but for you, what is in the next room? You know, this show, I love to explore other people and what they feel comes next after this life experience. And from the sound of it, for a good 8 minutes, you literally were in the next room.
Yes, exactly. What I feel and what I've grown to understand with my NDE and how it has contributed to my understanding of life, death, afterlife, I feel that we're here on this earth having an experience, having many experiences, and they are meant to grow our soul. And when we have our final moments on earth, we have a review, a life review that no one judges us on. We're able to see all of the aspects of our life and how we touched, reached out, and helped other people. Also, the negatives that we do, we're able to see those and not feel so great about them. But I really feel it's a growth experience for our souls. And then we transition to that other level. And I think energy is a possibility that we have multiple levels, but I have no idea. But what I feel is that, you know, all of us transfer over and we then are growing ourselves on the other side. And then we come back perhaps for multiple experiences, again, multiple lives that help us to understand our soul, consciousness, life, death, etc.
I love
so it. It's just an ongoing thing.
An ongoing thing. So did this experience change how you function today, day to day?
Yes, it really always changes the experiencers, and that's been very researched. And there are a lot of interesting things that happen to NDEers that they have no control of. And so they, like one of them is intuition. And the intuition that comes through in my life is really, really awesome, but it's also sometimes a little bit scary. And things, you know, that I'll know ahead of time have been happening to me since I was a young child. So when I found out that intuition was one of the after effects for having a near-death experience, it was an opening for me. And I ended up talking to one of the researchers, major researchers of NDEs, PMH Atwater, written probably 13, 14 books on the subject. And she was the one who told me, if your after effects from your NDE go further back than your age 31 NDE, you most likely had a previous experience that no one told you about and you don't remember. And so I ended up investigating that with my older brother and my older sister, and they ended up relating to me that I had died when I was 18 months old. Wow. That the parents, our parents, had told them never to talk about it, never to tell me. And I had had a high fever and gone into convulsions and ended up stopping breathing. And I was, my brother doesn't know how long I was dead, but he said he watched as I resuscitated without any assistance. And then I was in the hospital for 4 days afterwards. So both of them remember the situation. And, you know, I definitely had intuition all the way back to when I was young. It used to scare my mom incredibly when I would know who was calling on the phone, or I would be standing on a street corner and realize that a car was just going to crash into another car. And wow. I would react to that. And my mom would just be like, do not tell anyone you can do this. So it was weird.
So intuition is part of it. And then, so now here you are. I can't believe a half hour is almost gone. You are now the founder of IN Santa Barbara. So what is it, if somebody's watching this right now at the beautiful Dying Expo and they're like, wow, this is incredible. This happened to me and I wasn't able to talk about it. Where do they go to get the support? And is it a community of people that have had these experiences that gathers?
Yeah. Well, our group here has some experiencers, and we have a special earlier meeting than our main meeting. And the experience, we're not meeting right now, we're doing it online, of course, but we have an experiencers group prior to our main meeting. And then our main meeting has an experiencer or someone who has discussion about the afterlife that comes as our main speaker. And we tape record those. We were doing audio before we had COVID-19, and those were all posted up on SoundCloud.com. And you just have to put in their search bar, Ian's Santa Barbara, three different words. And then all of those audios are all there of, you know, guest speakers like Anita Morjani and Dr. Eben Alexander and Jeff Olson, key people who've, you know, been out there in the public's eye for quite a while here. And also now we're doing video and we're filming our speakers and we're putting it up on Facebook. So that's just www.facebook.com/IANDSSB, Ian's SB, all one word. So you can look at those, listen to them, and you know, grow from that. And there's also a lot on YouTube, as well as on the ians.org website and okay. the nderf.org website.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining my guest, Barbara Bartolome. I could talk to you all day. She is.
I love you, Jane.
I love you too. The founder of IN Santa Barbara, and welcome to the next room. It's been a joy to have you here. It's a beautiful Dine Expo, so please go and visit other booths and go see what this is all about, because this community, which was started by Michelle Little, has really helped to open up and bring us all together. That are having different experiences like what you've had. And so it's just really a positive, powerful community of death and dying people that aren't afraid to discuss what's going on the planet. I mean, that's a big deal that you went through, but it was 1987 and, you know, a lot of people were not discussing near-death experiences in 1987. So thank you for sharing your story. Any final thoughts before we close for the day in the next room?
Just to let everybody know that, you know, every kind thing that they do for others is going to be seen at the end of their life and how they touch and love other people. So try to focus on that in your life and let go of the other negatives.
Beautiful.
Negatives aren't important. Do the positives instead.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you so much for joining us in the next room. It's the beautiful Dying Expo. We're just thrilled to have you here. Please go check out all the booths and get the support and the love that you need. It's all here in this lovely community all weekend long. So thank you.
Perfect.
So
much. Everybody.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you. And I hope everybody watches everything that you've done, because you are an amazing human being bringing forth a lot of information to the world that's really critical at this time and in the future.
Join Jane again next week for The Next Room on Empower Radio as she examines the beliefs, traditions, and personal evidence of connection with those who have moved on to the next room.